Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Aguirre. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And welcome to X Squared Radio. So glad you're here with us tonight. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. By the way, I want to thank you for the interviews this week. James Gilliland's program last night on BBS Radio Network and Leah Shaney in Australia yesterday morning. Really, really good interviews. Thank you. Thank you so much, everyone, for having me on. The solar wind tonight is 304 kilometers per second, just in case you wanted to know. The proton count's down to 1.0, but I'm not worried about it because many of you are not going to the beach this month anyway. Giant sunspot AR1339 is crackling with M-class solar flares, unleashing at least five of them in the past 24 hours. The blasts have been coming with such thick frequency that photographers are able to catch them in sequence from Earth. Even bigger eruptions are possible before the weekend is over. So you might want to wear sunglasses tomorrow. AR1339 has a delta-class magnetic field, like a giant bar magnet that harbors energy for X-class flares, the most powerful of the flares. The sunspot is turning toward Earth, so the odds of a geo-effective flare are increasing. By the way, this flare, sunspot's about 70,000 kilometers in diameter. It is one that does have the potential of unleashing some geomagnetic activity on our electronics. It is the largest sunspot in decades. The sunspot behemoth isn't yet facing our planet. It will tomorrow. But it was spotted a couple of days ago as it came over the limb. Quite a surprise to see one this big and this well-organized. We see that the sun is becoming increasingly active. Now there are so many sunspots, you can see them with the naked eye at the end of the day when you're using a lot of the atmosphere as a filter. Lots of other Earth changes going on. There was a record 5.6 magnitude earthquake in Oklahoma today. It's not that unusual, even though it was a big earthquake for Oklahoma. Just about every year this time, they have a swarm of earthquakes. The Saturday night earthquake had a magnitude of 5.6. Its epicenter was 4 miles east of Sparks in Lincoln County, according to the Oklahoma's Geological Survey. The quake hit at 10:53 p.m., and it was reportedly felt as far away as Illinois, Kansas, Arkansas, Tennessee, and, you got it, Texas, the largest earthquake ever recorded in Oklahoma. But, you know, they had a quake last year of 3.1. 3.1. And there were lots of aftershocks at 3.4. Some cracks in some buildings, some dishes rattled. But this is not really a very large earthquake. Fortunately, there were no deaths reported, and I think just a couple of minor injuries. Also in the news this week, you know that YU-55, that's a huge asteroid that's passing by on Tuesday. A huge asteroid will pass closer to Earth than the moon. JPL is reporting about 221,000 miles away from Earth to around 200,000 miles away from Earth. That's plus or minus 20,000 miles in there. Now, it's not passing between the Earth and the moon. It's actually passing by the moon first and then the Earth as it heads on through the solar system. It's the first time since 1976 that an object of this size has passed this closely to the Earth. It gives us a great and rare chance to study
a near-Earth object like this. Astronomer Scott Fisher said he would say that. A program director with the National Science Foundation said this on Thursday. The orbit and position of the asteroid, which is about 1,312 feet in diameter, is well known, added senior research scientist Don Yeomans with NASA's JPL in Pasadena. He goes on to say there's no chance that this object will collide with the Earth or the Moon. Thousands of amateur and professional astronomers are expected to track YU-55's approach, which will be visible from the planet's northern hemisphere. It will be too dim to be seen with the naked eye. Okay, this is not a star. It's not a satellite. There's not any solar panels on it. It is not giving off any light. It's a big black rock. But you will be able to see it if you have a pretty good telescope. It's going to be moving quick. The best time to observe it would be early in the evening on November 8th, 2 days from now, on Tuesday, from the east coast of the United States. It's going to be very faint, even at the closest approach. You'll need a decent-sized telescope, probably a refracting telescope, and I would recommend at least a 4-inch lens. You're probably going to need a 6-inch lens to see this. That's a pretty expensive refracting scope. You will not probably be able to see this with a reflecting scope. Mirrors are made to gather a lot of light, but they don't have a lot of small resolution, so you may not be able to see something this small. They suspect it's been visiting Earth for thousands of years, but because of gravitational tugs here and there, they cannot tell for sure how long the asteroid has been in its present orbit. I hope that it doesn't come around too often, because this time it's going to be tugged by the Moon and by the Earth, and next time it might come a little closer. I like the confidence in this statement. We do not think that it will ever impact the Earth or Moon, but we only have its orbit calculated for the next 100 years. Just to keep things amusing, Richard Hoagland stated this week that he thought there was a good chance the asteroid will hit the Moon. I would say that if the asteroid is alone, there's little chance of this occurring. If there are some luggage coming with it, as there likely could be, it is possible that one or more of them could be attracted to the Moon. They're still more than 200,000 miles from Earth, so there's little chance of it interacting with the Earth in that way. I think, in my personal opinion, it's a big professional stretch for somebody to say it will hit the Moon, or there's a good chance of it hitting the Moon. I guess if your credibility is waning, you might as well go out on a limb. If it doesn't hit the Moon, well, what's it going to do to you? But if it does hit the Moon, that's a pretty big boost in your ability to predict things. By the way, I want to let you know, those of you that are joining us just after the hour here on X Squared Radio, I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and in the second hour tonight, we are interviewing Rico Paganini. Rico Paganini is really a world-class author and a world-class compiler of research. He's come out with a book, the first in a series, that's called Giza Legacy. And it's about the pyramids, and we've interviewed people about the pyramids before here. We've interviewed Robert Balval and others, and certainly experts all, William Henry, not to say the least of which. But Rico Paganini, born in 1962, is an independent bookseller and a publisher who has worked since 1987 in the German-speaking regions of Europe on the establishment of media as a professional discipline. He began going to Egypt in the year 2000 and really became fascinated with not only the evidence that that the pyramids were built long, long before the Egyptians ever got there, like 14 or 15,000 years ago, but that there were multiple layers to the pyramid, some subterranean chambers, and that the technology that it took to build the temples was known around the world in various civilizations. So that interview is about an hour long. It's pre-recorded. We had to do it this morning because he is in Switzerland. So if you're interested in this subject, you're not going to hear a better interview than this. Call up your friends, call up your family. If they like Discovery Channel, History Channel, stuff like that, this is going to leave that in the dust. You're really going to hear things you've never heard before. Rico Paganini is a great publisher, and he's put together this really world-class book. It's hardcover. It's full of color photographs. It's got a lot of 3D images in it. It's called Giza Legacy, and you're really going to enjoy this interview. That's going to come up at the top of the hour. Now, interesting stuff in the news. I mean, just it's hard to keep up with it this week. UFO statement by the White House press secretary. Yes, it's true. I mean, our good friend Stephen Bassett and his group, Paradigm Research, has kept constant pressure on the White House by assembling not just form letters, but literally tens of thousands of signatures on petitions because Obama has come out and said, look, we want to be a transparent White House. If you ask a question, we'll come up with an answer. You know, even if you don't like it, we'll come up with an answer. But at least, you know, they've opened the door. They've sort of rolled out a short red carpet and said, hey, come on up to the doorstep here and ask a question. So Stephen Bassett, in a very organized fashion, and if you've ever heard Stephen Bassett on this program, you know that he's a very eloquent speaker. He has a tremendous amount of factual information, testimony, and evidence at his fingertips and in his organization. He's well-organized, well-documented, and literally has hundreds of credible witnesses, former government workers and officials and Air Force pilots and commercial pilots that have come forward and made statements and given evidence and photos and film and radar signatures, etc. So they've made a credible question to the White House, and this is their official statement. You may have heard it in the news. It was only up on Drudge for about 1 hour, and it disappeared today. If I did not read online newspapers as often as I do, I would have missed it, and I'm sure you did too. So here is the official statement. Are you ready? The U.S. government has no evidence that any life exists outside our planet or that an extraterrestrial presence has contacted or engaged any member of the human race. This is Phil Larson from the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, reported on the whitehouse.gov website. He goes on to say, in addition, oh yeah, there's more. In addition, there is no credible information to suggest that any evidence is being hidden from the public's view. Well, that's the official statement, folks. If you missed it, you can play it back on the archives. It's going to be difficult to find on the web. You might have to go to the whitehouse.gov website, and they may have already taken it down because they really are embarrassed to make a statement like this. Why? Well, for one thing, it's got extraterrestrial in the text. For another, it is so blatantly false. I'm just going to come out and say it, underline it, capitalize it. As if this is not enough news, there seems to be more action by the government to stop the flow of information to the people. It's as if all of a sudden the government has something very, very large it does not want us to know. If you don't believe me, here to talk about it is Fox News contributor Judge Napolitano. Now, I know you like Judge Napolitano, so I want to play this clip for you. I think that I think you'll be impressed by it, and you'll be frightened. Here we go.
The government works for us and is accountable to us, and thus must be transparent to us. This seems pretty basic to everyone except the government. A case in point is the curious attitude that the feds now have about the Freedom of Information Act, commonly known by its initials, FOIA. FOIA is a federal law enacted in 1966 that requires the government to make its documents available to anybody who wants to see them. There are exceptions in the statute, of course, for military, diplomatic, and national security secrets, and for personnel matters about government employees. But for the most part, FOIA exposes the government to the folks who own and employ it. That is you, America. The presumption in FOIA is that every document that the government has is available to anyone who wants to see it. Thus, it is not the obligation of the person seeking the documents to demonstrate his need for them before they're turned over. It is the obligation of the government to demonstrate its need for secrecy in order to keep from handing the documents over. This is not an academic distinction. This presumption requires the government to search for whatever is demanded and to keep a record of whatever it finds and to tell the person seeking the documents whether it will turn them over or whether it will not turn them over on the basis of the statute. Once the government tells the person seeking the documents that it has the documents he seeks but chooses not to reveal them, that person can just accept that or appeal the government's decision to a federal judge. Then the government must show those documents that it wants to keep secret to a federal judge, and the judge will decide if the government is right or wrong. Sometimes the government pulls a fast one and deep-seeks documents it doesn't want anybody to see. But destroying government property is a felony, and most federal employees, we can safely assume, don't want to go to jail. So most will candidly tell the court what they found and why it should be an exception to the presumption of openness. All this was the law until now. Now comes the Obama administration Justice Department with an incredible proposed rule that sounds as if it were straight out of George Orwell's terrifying novel, 1984. Freedom Watch viewers have heard me argue that the government lies, cheats, and steals. Now the feds want legal permission to do so. Here's the latest. The so-called Department of Justice is charged with administering FOIA, and in the process of doing so, from time to time, it proposes rules and procedures to the government employees who have custody of documents. Those rules are available to the public and to Congress for 30 days. If the Congress does not intercede, then the proposed rules become law. I know. The Constitution says that only Congress can write the laws, but you know how far we've strayed from the Constitution. So here's what happened. 2 weeks ago, the Justice Department actually proposed a rule that permits custodians of documents anywhere in the federal government to lie about whether the documents being sought actually exist, to lie to you when you seek the documents, to lie to other federal employees about the location of the documents, and incredibly, to lie to federal judges when the documents are presented for review. Congress can invalidate this proposed rule by a majority vote of both houses, but it must do so soon. So the government, which does work for us, which derives all of its powers from us, which has sworn to uphold the Constitution for us, now wants to give itself the lawful power to lie to us. This is the hope and change and transparency that entered the White House 2.5 years ago. And this must be rejected.
This is the hope and transparency that entered the White House 2.5 years ago. So now you see that the official White House press statement from the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy makes an official statement that the U.S. government has no evidence that any life exists outside our planet or that an extraterrestrial presence has contacted or engaged any member of the human race, including you. And in addition, there is no credible information to suggest that any evidence is being hidden from the public's view. Now, I can assure you that my good friend Stephen Bassett is not going to take this lying down. He is not going to let some underling in the government brush this aside with a two-sentence official statement. He is going to go back at it. He is going to get a more refined petition, and he is going to go back at it, and hopefully, Congress will act in the next 10 days and reverse Obama's effort to negate the Freedom of Information Act. It's our government. The documents belong to us. And unless it has something to do with national security or military secrets, we deserve to see them. Now, if you have a comment on this, I would love to hear about it. You can get it. Call us toll-free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, you can reach us at 530-413-4511. And I suggest that you do your Christmas shopping early because the pickings are going to be slim this year. Many chains and stores and producers and retailers are carrying limited amounts in your size and color because they're afraid they're going to be left with inventory come the first of the year. They don't want that. They don't want the after Christmas sale. They want to sell everything at a profit. And they want to be sold out by Christmas. So while you are out and about, I suggest that you call into our conference line, which is 760-569-7676. You can dial the passcode 192-919-pound. Just put it on speed dial. And remember 192-919-pound. And you can listen to X Squared Radio while you're out shopping on your Bluetooth. So, yes, you can have that strangely informed smile on your face while you're picking through the various colors of boots for this winter. The search for alien footprints continues. Scientists rethink the hunt for E.T. Any intelligent extraterrestrial life that exists probably won't announce itself by blowing up the White House or win over the hearts of children as a lovable alien with a glowing finger. Many scientists simply hope to find evidence of them by scanning the skies for a radio signal from a distant star's alien civilization. But such efforts may also risk overlooking clues of past alien activity right here on Earth. If aliens did leave their mark on Earth by some wild chance, we could search for the possible footprints of alien technology or even analyze the DNA of terrestrial organisms for signs of intelligent messages or tinkering. Such a CSI-style forensics search could complement rather than replace the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, or SETI, astronomers who continue to look skyward, said Paul Davies, a physicist and cosmologist at Arizona State University. He goes on to say, "My proposals aim to spread the burden from a small band of heroic radio astronomers to the entire scientific community. Projects like Genomic SETI are an attempt to complement radio SETI." Davies wants scientists to broaden their thinking about how aliens could have left behind their mark. Having worked with SETI for 3 decades, he has written about his ideas in a book, The Eerie Silence. But Davies does not think such intelligent alien life must necessarily exist, and his many years of supporting SETI have not stopped him from describing the needle-in-a-haystack search as a search without any clue as to whether there is a needle there at all or how large the haystack may be. They're also looking for alien signposts. They're also looking for things that might have been left behind. There's a chance that past visits to the Earth by alien life left signs much closer to home, but probably they're going to be difficult to find. They might be at the bottom of the ocean. They might be tremendously old. They might appear so alien that we don't recognize them. If there is another form of life on Earth, we could find it within 20 years or so if we take the trouble to look, Davies told Astrobiology magazine. Of course, it may not be there, but searching our own planet is far easier than searching another one. That's what I've always said with the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. Why are we not sailing the seas that have never been sailed? Why are we not looking at the ocean's floors for ancient civilizations, or should I say, civilizations that may still be living there, just separate from us. Alien messages in a bottle or artifacts similar to the monoliths of, say, 2001 A Space Odyssey would seem less likely to survive for hundreds of millions of years on Earth because of geological and weather forces. We've always said that, but what if those alien forces never left? What if they didn't multiply like humans, but they're here in small numbers in remote places of the Earth? Citizen scientists and school students could pitch in to run genomic versions of SETI to find such traces, Davies said. Data mining software programs could do much of the heavy lifting, as just a small part of the usual genomic analysis goes on just about every day in this research. Alien bioengineering might have also created a shadow biosphere of life built upon biochemistry separate from that of Earth life. Examples would be life forms that don't use DNA or protein or incorporate different elements in their biochemistry than all other known life forms on Earth do. Scientists have already begun major efforts to find shadow biospheres, but of natural rather than artificial origins. For instance, we have life forms that exist in the most harsh environments of Earth, at inside volcanoes or at the very depths of the sea where pressures and temperatures are such that we wouldn't think life would exist, but it does. It exists. It flourishes. It gives birth and lives its life and respirates and dies. But it doesn't live in an environment that we would understand necessarily. If scientists find weird shadow organisms that arose separately from Earth life forms we know, that won't necessarily suggest intelligent alien involvement, but such a find could give more credibility to the idea that life had a good chance of arising when given the right circumstances, rather than simply being a one-time freak accident. I mean, you look at Earth and you realize that 90 to 95% of the species that have lived on Earth are extinct, and yet we still have a plethora of life forms on Earth. It really blows your mind. You really start thinking, wow, how many different fish were there? How many different birds were there? How many different insects were there? How many different forms of intelligent life have been on this planet in the past? It's just interesting stuff. So, and we want to cover a lot more information tonight. I want to let you know Rico Paganini is going to be on in the second hour. His book, Giza Legacy, a hardbound color photographs, 3D images, amazing evidence brought in from the likes of J.J. Hertog and Robert Balval and others, and his own research. It's really, really well done. He's going to come on in the second hour. It's a pre-recorded interview that we did early this morning because he's in Switzerland. I really encourage you to hang around and listen to that. That will be 1 hour, and then we'll go back to being live in the third hour. Our phone number is here, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. Everywhere else on the planet, and by the way, I'm really thankful for Leah Shaney for having me on her radio program in Australia yesterday morning. It was a great pleasure to meet her and be on with her co-host. A very, very gracious program. I encourage you to get over to Leah Shaney, S-H-A-N-E-Y, and pick up her broadcast in Australia. Lots of good, I was going to say customers, not fans, but people that have read Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, and we appreciate you. So anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you want to reach us, it's 530-413-4511. In the past few months, we have done some work on engineered foods, genetically engineered foods, and genetically engineered products. And the response has really been overwhelming. Many of you have asked for the research paper that I had put together. It was about 37 pages. I did not get a chance to cover it all during the three-hour program. If you want a copy of that, you can email me at bagnew@x2-radio.com. I'll be happy to send you a copy of it. But there's more to this. The EU this week banned a patent of stem cells if the embryo is destroyed. The reason this is important, and it really gets to medical ethics and to the ethics of life itself. Europe's top court on Tuesday of this last week banned researchers from patenting any processes to extract stem cells when it leads to the destruction of a human embryo. In a ruling that could affect medical research, and it most certainly will, the EU Court of Justice said the use of human embryos for therapeutic or diagnostic purposes, which are applied to the human embryo and are useful to its patentability, are not to be admitted, but their use for purposes of scientific research is not patentable, the court ruled. The EU judges were asked by the German Federal Court of Justice to provide an interpretation of a human embryo, followed by an appeal from a German scientist whose patent on a method to create nerve cells from human embryonic stem cells was ruled invalid. The scientist, Oliver Brustel, said there were already clinical applications for his invention to treat patients with Parkinson's disease. And what this really boils down to, Earth Explorers, is the value of life itself. There was a book that was written years ago. Hang on a moment while I wash this down my throat. Still got a little bit of a dry throat from the plague over the last couple of weeks. This book was called The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. And I believe it was written by Ursula K. Le Guin. I read this story, I don't know, 25, 28 years ago. And it was a story of a mythical city called Omelas, where everything was wonderful, everything was grand. You know, parades every day, bounty, freedom from illness, no war, no pestilence, beautiful homes, wonderful foods, just a great medieval kind of setting with lots of music and great smells. And a visitor was writing and commenting about all of this in the story. And he realized that as utopian as this society was, that there were certain numbers of the people that didn't stay. They walked away from Omelas. They left this wonderful heaven on earth, and they went into the wilderness or to other towns to struggle and experience strife and scarcity and disease and jealousy and all of those things which appeared to not exist at Omelas. At some point in time, it became time for him to make his decision on whether he was going to stay in Omelas or not, as if there were any doubts in his mind. But he was taken to a certain house, and the house was opened to him, and he was led through the house to the basement, and he went down the stairs into the basement. And in the basement there was a child that was captive, held there by a tether of chains, fed like an animal, barely kept alive. This was the price that Omelas paid for its wonderful utopian lifestyle. One child, held in this captivity, paid the price so that all the blessings of heaven could be released upon the community. And for some, not many, but for some, the price was too high, and they walked away from Omelas. And that is what this stem cell research is really about. We are talking about creating human beings at the very most basic level, just a few cells, just enough so that the cells begin to differentiate in enough volume. First two cells, of course, a sperm and an egg coming together. very rapidly forming a blastule, and then a simple organism with a spinal cord, the heart begins beating after less than 3 weeks. The eye begins to form, the brain stem begins to form. And within 10 weeks, all the fingers and toes, arms and legs, everything is there, slowly begins to develop into a human being. Somewhere in that process, Earth explorers, it is called an embryo. It isn't called a human. And somewhere in that immense value of creation, that pinnacle of evolution and engineering, that design of DNA as proteins unfold and refold, dozens of times an hour, is the secret to life. And we, intelligent, living, jealous, ill, some in pain, some dying, some just simply growing old, find that keeping that embryo at the end of a chain in the basement, below the lens of the microscope, or in the frozen fog of a nitrogen cooler, is a price to pay for life, for health, for beauty. And so far, the leaders, those that are in charge of the rules and regulations, are the ones who are leading away from Omelas. When we stop walking away, when we embrace the harvesting, the planting and harvesting of human life, life that cannot speak for itself, life that does not breathe air yet, may barely breathe amniotic fluid, if at all. Maybe they're born in a soup or a slurry of some media that keeps them alive just long enough to blend them up into some concoction that allows them to stimulate life in a way that it forgot how to do once we became a mature fetus, once we came forth from the womb spewing amniotic fluid and gulping air for the first time. We stopped being stem cells. We started being a human, multiplying and growing. But if we lose a limb, it's gone. If we lose an organ, it's gone. We don't grow another one. We can't remember how to do it. Our DNA is not made that way. So to dip down into the bowels of creation crosses the line of ethics. And so far, science is trying to walk that line. But the Luxembourg-based court said that a process which involves the removal of a stem cell from a human embryo at the blastocyst stage, entailing the destruction of that embryo, cannot be patented. I tell you, Earth explorers, once it can be patented, which means the process, the discovery, is then owned by a company, more than likely a pharmaceutical company. Once that day happens, humanity will not walk away from Omelas. We may live forever. We may cure diabetes, Parkinson's disease. We may cure Alzheimer's. We may cure heart disease. We may grow new kidneys. But at what cost? What, indeed, is at the end of the chain? If you have thoughts about it, I'd like to hear it. Toll free, North America, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else, on planet or off planet, 530-413-4511. And if you're out there walking around listening to this program on our conference line at 760-569-7676, and you remembered to dial the passcode 192919#, maybe you should stop just for a moment and contemplate what that means for the ethics of the human race. because, you know, a blastocyst is very small, can fit on the head of a pin, and it will take many, many to develop a dose of stem cells to treat those of us who can vote. Just a thought. Now, there are a lot of things going on out there, and no small amount of discussion of protest. It seems to be spreading. Although there was a vote of confidence in Greece over the bailout of Greek finances, you know, Greece got itself in a lot of trouble by letting people retire at 50 and paying them a pension for the rest of their lives, which I'm sure were long and full of white wine and all the fish you could consume. And also free medical care, and not just for Greeks. People from other countries would travel to Greece specifically for the free medical care. People that needed knee surgery or some elective surgery, which they might have to wait for years, say in Israel or in one of the other countries, they could simply come to Greece and get it done. It buried him. It just buried him. The leadership of Greece, election after election after election, just gave the people more and more and more. And, of course, the people voted for themselves a piece of the coffer. And before too long, Greece could not afford Greece anymore. And so they're on the verge of bankruptcy. Now, austerity measures have been put in place. That means a cutback in your allowance, folks. That's what that means. It means you have to get out and get a job, okay? Grow up, get a job. Get a job. Move away from mom and dad. That means that this vote of confidence at least voted for the process, but we've had several of the politicians resign. And no small amount of protests in Greece. We've seen the cars overturned. We've seen the Molotov cocktails thrown. We've seen the rocks and fist fights and stick fights in the middle of the street. And that has spread. I don't think it started in Egypt. That was a completely different thing, throwing Mubarak out. And now we've wrested Libya from its 42 years of despotism. Maybe they'll get the $200 billion he and his family took from the people. Maybe they won't. Hard to tell. But we do see protest happening all over the world. Does it have a voice? No. Does it have a clear message? No. It's just protest for protest. Now, I do kind of understand what they're talking about, but they don't know how to state it. They don't know how to take a position. They're hurting the very people they're trying to help. They're protesting because they don't know what else to do. But here's what it boils down to. Wall Street has figured out a way with extremely fast computers, and I'm talking about computers that switch faster than anything NASA has online. Anything NASA has online. And these computers trade stock and currencies and securities back and forth dozens of times a month. Now, we're not talking a big amount of profit each time. Incremental amounts, a fraction of a percent here, a fraction of a percent there. But over a month's time, these funds can make 30 to 50% profit. Off what? Off of nothing. There is no value added whatsoever. The cash that's in the system doesn't even belong to them. It doesn't even belong to them, but they trade it back and forth, from one security to another, like a ping pong game, like a Ponzi scheme. And each day, the stock market will go up and down, but nobody loses. The only people that lose are the companies that they designed to lose. The ones that make money are the ones they designed to make money. The bottom line is this: they're making cash. And lots of it. But the companies that they're trading don't get a dime of that money. They can't hire one more secretary. They can't hire anybody to cut the grass. They can't hire another person to turn a screwdriver, because the cash doesn't go to the companies. It goes to their brokers. It goes to the people who own that stock. Now, in the old days, it used to be that these people were taking a risk. They were putting up their money. They were investing in a company. They were investing in a pharmaceutical. They were investing in a manufacturing plant. They were investing in an idea or an innovation, some technology. That's not true anymore. The only thing they're investing in is the paper itself that has been counterfeited back and forth between these companies. There is no value. There is no gold. Nothing is there. And yet the CEOs and the middle managers and the upper managers and executives of these companies are pocketing trillions and trillions of dollars every single year. That's what the protests are about. What can we do about it? Sorry, people. You're standing in the wrong place. You don't need to be protesting in Atlanta. You don't protest in Los Angeles. You don't protest in New York. You don't protest in Boston. If you want to protest and get these things changed, you protest in Washington. That's what you need to do. You need to put the SEC chairman behind bars. You need to put the head of the Department of Justice behind bars. You need to impeach this president if you want to see action happen. That's where the high crime and misdemeanors have occurred. Now, as if this is not enough to exacerbate things, these are, by and large, mostly peaceful protests. Yes, you get the same cross of, you know, walks of life in this as you do anything else. Maybe a little less, because most of the people that are protesting out there are either underemployed or unemployed. And so there are a lot of shenanigans going on out there, a lot of drug dealing, pimping, and raping, and just lowlifes out there in the middle of the night, slipping from tent to tent and taking advantage of people. I would admonish you to behave yourselves out there, people. Behave yourselves, because the police and the military are just looking for a reason to mop the streets with you. Just to give you an example, there was a United States Marine Corps Sergeant, Shamar Thomas, we've talked about him a couple times on this program, from Roosevelt, New York, went toe-to-toe with the New York Police Department, which have been notoriously violent. You've seen the YouTubes out there. You've seen the clips on some of the news stations will play it, some won't, where they just simply walk up to protesters who are sitting on the sidewalk, minding their own business, singing Kumbaya, and spray them in the face with pepper spray. You want to know what it feels like? Well, go get some household ammonia, mix it with vinegar, and spray it in your eyes and see what you feel like. Now you'll get an idea. An activist in the Occupy Wall Street movement, Thomas, voiced his opinions of the New York Police Department brutality that had and has been plaguing the Occupy movement. Thomas is a 24-year-old Marine veteran, two tours in Iraq. He currently plays amateur football and is in college. He's also about 6'17" and well-trained. Thomas comes from a long line of people who sacrifice for their country. Mother, Army veteran, Iraq. Stepfather, Army, active duty, Afghanistan. Grandfather, Air Force veteran, Vietnam. Great-grandfather, Navy veteran, World War II. Sometimes the right person with the right words and motivation can make a difference. Their intention is so powerful. Their words are so true. You can watch this video, or I'll play the audio for you right now so you can listen to the passion of this man's words. Now, keep in mind that the police are facing him down and walking him backwards. This is what he had to say. It gets quite agitating and very high energy. But I want you to listen to this. This is what you should be saying to these police on a sidewalk. Here we go.
Have a good night, guys. You see it, baby. They don't lie.
Let's go.
They don't lie.
He's showing off his medals.
They don't lie, tough guy.
This is not a war zone. This is not a war zone. These are unarmed people. It doesn't make you tough to hurt these people. It doesn't make you tough to hurt these people. It doesn't. I don't care. I don't care about these people. I put in my work. It doesn't lie. It does not make you tough to hurt these people. There's nothing tough about it. Nothing. If you want to go fight, go to Iraq and Afghanistan. But you want to be here hurting U.S. citizens. Where is that in the contract?
By the way, it's 10 to 1. 10 cops to this one sergeant.
U.S. citizens! U.S. citizens! U.S. It does not make you want to do this to them. It doesn't. Stop hurting these people, man. Why are y'all doing this to our people? I've been to Iraq 14 months for my people. You come over here and you hurt them. They don't have guns. They don't have guns. They don't. Why are you hurting these people? It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. How do you sleep at night? There is no honor in this. There is no honor in this. There is no honor in this, man. There's no honor in this shit. There is no honor in this shit. There is no honor in what you're doing to these people. No honor. How you do it to people? How you do it to people? How you sleep at night doing this to people?
Come on, sir.
How you do this to people?
Let's go.
How? You're here to protect them. You're here to protect us. Protect us. Why are you hurting U.S. citizens? This is the United States of America. Why are you hurting people? If you want to go kill and hurt people, go to Iraq. Why are you hurting U.S. citizens? Why? What sense does it make? Do you get honor out of this? Do you get honor out of hitting people with batons? Is that what you get? Why are you doing this?
We gotta walk down a block over there.
We're just trying to move your car.
This is unbelievable that y'all are doing this to people. That y'all are doing this to people.
Now, the police are continually trying to herd these people down the sidewalk. They don't want them on the sidewalk. They don't want these protesters here. They're under orders to move these people out. And this one man is trying to keep this peaceful.
Protected this country. I understand, but I'm not out here trying to hurt these people. I'm not walking around trying to hurt
people.
Who's in Iraq with him?
So why do you allow this? Why are they walking around trying to hurt people?
Let's go, folks. Please, I'm asking you nicely. Let's walk down the block, please.
And I can't speak. Y'all want to shut me up.
Now there are about 100 policemen out here.
Why are y'all treating people like this? Why are y'all gearing up like this is war? This is not war.
They've got helmets, shields, sticks, and guns. And this one man is holding them off.
People without guns. Nobody's trying to hurt you guys. There are no bullets flying out here. There are no bullets flying. How tough are you? How tough are you?
There's no honor in hurting unarmed civilians.
You get no respect. What did you see tonight that bothered you?
I was here October 5th. I saw them beating people. People that had nothing to do with anything, just grabbing people out of the crowd. There's no honor in that. My mom, my father, everybody has served in Iraq, Afghanistan. Well, I did 14 months in Iraq. My father was in Afghanistan. My mother did a year in Iraq. We fought for this country. I don't come home. I'm in New York City. I am from New York City. And these cops are hurting people that I fought to protect. There's no reason for this. There's no honor in hurting unarmed civilians. And I won't let it happen. Have a good night.
All right, that's one level of the protest that's out there. Now, I understand there may be high emotions about this. I understand that, you know, that the lowest common denominator has been paraded in front of the cameras, and you know, I think the press kind of does that. They just look for people that don't really make a clear statement, or they make these disjointed statements about how maybe they want all the debts forgiven, or they want credit bureau outlawed or something like that. These are things that just don't make sense. They're things that the less educated might put forth. And I understand that. But a protest is kind of a mishmash. It's kind of chaos. And out of chaos, you know, comes this raw emotion, like you heard this sergeant. So anyway, I would really like to hear your thoughts. So let's go to the phones. Let's see. Let's take Matt from Montana. Welcome to the program, sir. Oh, well, he was, he just wanted to, I don't know what he wanted to say, but he didn't want to be screened, so he hung up. Well, listen, Matt, don't be afraid. You can speak whatever you want to say here, as long as it's not too profane. I think that protesting is a right here in this country. You don't have to be eloquent. You don't really have to have a message. I understand that a lot of the restaurants, coffee shops, local shops on these sidewalks are really having a hard time because the police have barricaded the sidewalks. The people that are out there don't have any money. And so they are actually hurting the people that they're trying to protest for. And, you know, that's tragic. Maybe they should go home, work for a couple of weeks, kind of protest in shifts. But I don't think they're in the right place. In my opinion, they're not in the right place. They don't need to be in Los Angeles. They don't need to be in Little Rock. They don't need to be in Atlanta or Boston or New York. They need to be in Washington. They need to have a 5 million man march on Washington and say, enough is enough. Start putting some of these criminals in jail. And that's just my personal opinion about it. Now, in the third hour, we're going to talk about how brain gene activity is changing throughout your life. We've got some great articles we're going to be covering, and some more audio that we'll be releasing. We're going to give you a Fukushima update in Japan, so I don't want you to miss that. But in the second hour, right after our musical break here, we're going to be bringing on a pre-recorded interview with Rico Paganini. I want you to hang around for that. That is a great interview we had this morning. It's about his great book, Giza Legacy. It is the first volume in a 3-volume set. The second one is called The Day Legacy, and that's Day as in D-E-I. It is not in English yet. It's in German. It's being translated as we speak. It should be out in a couple of months. That book ties the 4 great ancient calendars together. Now, keep in mind, none of these calendars are based in religion. They're based in ancient mathematics. Yes, it's the Maya calendar, and other calendars are all tied together. And believe it or not, they all correlate with one another about this 26,000-year procession, about the fact that 2012 is sort of a control-alt-delete period. No, it doesn't mean great destruction. It could be, but it's not going to be the annihilation of the human race. It's probably going to be more an awakening of the human race. So I'm excited about it. I think you're going to enjoy it. I think that this interview is really going to be something that that you'll enjoy. Rico Paganini, I'm just looking for a piece of music to play. Ah, I found exactly the piece I want to play. Here we go. We'll be back in about 3 minutes with more X Squared Radio. Don't go away. Saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archer split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century.
was lying in a burned out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship fly in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seat to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seat to a new home in the sun.
And welcome, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. My guest today is Rico Paganini. His book is Giza Legacy. Now, I think you've probably have read a book or two or seen a few things about Giza. You may have even been there. But I can promise you, you've never held a book like this in your hands. The quality of this book is so high. It is really stunning. It needs to be a textbook. It's that well written. Rico Paganini, welcome to X Squared Radio. How are you, sir?
Thank you very much. I'm well, and I send you our greetings from the top of the mountains of Switzerland.
I can't tell you what it means to me. You know, this book you've written and published called Giza Legacy is the highest quality work I have ever seen on the subject. The pictures, the text, the drawings, they're just fabulous. The details.
Thank you very much.
The details available in this book far exceed anything I have read before. How long have you been researching the ancient mysteries in Egypt?
To be honest, it started in the year 2000, so it's about 10 years now.
And what fascinated you most when you first arrived at Giza? Were you part of a tour group? Did you go there on your own? What caused you to really latch onto this project and research this to this level?
It was like a small group of friends which have worked together for years on these subjects. And on the first trip in the year 2000, it was more to research and to still our wondering about these buildings of the pyramids and the vibration caused by the holy geometry and the geomantic power of this place. This was our main purpose first. But then when I was standing first time in front of the three pyramids and the Sphinx, I was such in a manner overwhelmed that I wanted to know more, because it was immediately clear to me, like I know for you, Brooks, that this could not be built by the pharaonic dynasties. And then I started to read and compare, to documentate through really all the fields around Giza. You know, the old, the scientific, the historical, and the spiritual sources also. And I traveled already 12 times to Giza, coming back now in October from the last one, and each time encountered still more about the amazing complex and the uprising overview, so that my interest and, let's say, my devotion and my guidance still continue to increase on this place. And we really hope for, let's say, breakthrough between this winter and spring 2012.
Yeah, I felt the same thing. You know, when I arrived in Giza, there's this what people call the Giza glow. It's kind of a throbbing energy. It's difficult to explain. It's really mind opening. But what really strikes the senses, I think, is that you walk up to this complex, which is really quite vandalized compared to what it was when it was originally built, and yet. The structure of it, the precision of it, the size of it, the scope of the engineering project is so far beyond anything that we attribute to an ancient Earth civilization. And it's those three pyramids are so different than all the other pyramids that you see really around Egypt. You say to yourself, you know, wait a minute, these weren't the last pyramids built. These were the first pyramids built.
Yeah, so I divide it in the same sense. We have just these three, I call them megalithic pyramids, and also the Sphinx, and all the more than 1,000 pyramids you find in Egypt is just to try to build again something like this. But you have just to look at the material. At the three megalithic pyramids, we have huge stone, cutted stone blocks, and in the other 1,000 pyramids, they will be just with mud bricks, and they not really standing anymore. Just the Snofru pyramid in Saqqara, it has some kind of similarity, and this is for me like a link, or also like a proof to test some of construction techniques. But you're right, the three pyramids, let's look first a moment to the small and the middle pyramid. The chambers are not even in, but they are below these two pyramids. So the whole pyramid is put on the top of the chambers, which are cut out from the limestone underground, and it's really meant with cut it out. It's incredible also this technique to do this. And just in the third, in the big pyramid, there are officially like four chambers. One is again like under, and three of these official chambers are just here inside the pyramid. We're talking about the gallery chamber, the queen's chamber, and the king's chamber. But unofficially, there have been discovered already 8 chambers more. This would mean totally around 12 chambers in and below the big pyramid. And there are lots of tunnels and shafts which connect these chambers, and also the three pyramids with the Sphinx.
Well, you know, we have all heard rumors over the years of underground tunnels and chambers in Egypt, especially in Giza. But in your book, you have pictures and maps of these. How do you think they were built, really, and why? I mean, I also notice in your pictures there's no evidence of soot or, like, residue from fire. How did they illuminate these chambers while they were building them and working in them?
Oh, you make a big jump, Brooke. Maybe, if you allow me, it's better to first see what are the proofs, the official proofs that the pyramids are built by the pharaohs, before we come to the big question, who really have built them and who has really built also the underground structure, if you agree.
Sure. Oh, yeah, sure, let's do that.
Yes, because if we look about the proofs. It's very interesting. You know, you were there, you have just already a big knowledge, but maybe some of your listeners not, and it's very special to know that we learn in school and all around the world that three pyramids were graves, finally, grave chamber, burial chambers for the pharaohs. But there were never find mummies or other things which proved that there were graves inside. And the second is, we have not just one hieroglyph that you can find in or outside the three pyramids. And if you compare it with the real graves of the pharaohs in the Valley of the Kings and Queens in Luxor, there you see that all is really filled with all their stories and signs and their life stories. And every pharaoh has mentioned every details what he has done or even how many slaves they have. But no one of these three pharaohs, Cheops, Khefren, and Mykerinos, have ever claimed that they have built these pyramids.
Oh, that would seem like a major deletion from their story. I mean, that's not like something, oh yeah, by the way, we built these pyramids.
Yes, you can be sure if they have done this, it would be the first they mentioned, I have built this and this pyramid. And if we look at the proofs, there I was also very surprised that finally they are really, really small. We have one hieroglyphic that is put outside the small pyramid, but it's very bad done and it's finished in the middle because it was nearly impossible to put a sign on the red granite, because also very interesting and urgent to know, the used red granite is harder than iron. Imagine this.
Well, so the modern, I was going to say modern Egyptians, they didn't have tools to be able to carve into granite. So they couldn't make a clear picture.
Yeah, they have just copper instruments, and you know, copper you can even form with your hands, and they have just the stone hammers. So even to break a part away from this red granite, it's not impossible, but it's impossible to cut them in this perfect size and weights.
So the cartouche that's on the pyramid is really nothing more than latent graffiti.
Yes, it's a good explanation. The other, what they call proof, is that they have found near the temple at the Sphinx, they have found a Khefrem statue, which was put down in a big hole. And they say, because we have found this statue here, so Khefrem was the builder. So it's, let's say, we have the White House now with a lot of statues of the presidents of America. And if they find it, let's say, in 4,000 years, and they find a figure there of President Obama, they say, okay, this was built by President Obama. So it's really, it makes no sense.
You're right.
And then we have a very small stela which was found near the Sphinx. And there a part of a name, but it's not even the full name, ends in the same way like Khefrem. So this also by scientifics is refused, and they say this is not what we can use as proof. And the last small thing what they have is a painted hieroglyphics which was found in the relieving chambers upper the king's chamber in the big pyramid. It's painted in red color, but it's already also declared as fake because the finder, Howard Wise, has done this because it's a typo painted inside, which is exactly the same typo of the school book of his time about hieroglyphics.
So he copied the mistake.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And these are all what we have as proof for the theory of the Egyptology that these three amazing megalithic pyramids were built by the pharaohs.
Well, one of the most controversial things about the complex at Giza, and I say controversial because, you know, Zawi Hawass is, you know, that was the head over all of the antiquities in Egypt. I don't know what his holding over this over these antiquities is after the revolution that occurred late last year. But the most controversial thing about it is the age of the complex. I've always thought that the first three pyramids, of course, were the originals, and all the others were attempts at copying them. And I guess them to be somewhere around 10,000 years old. How old do you think they really are?
I agree completely. You're right with this. And so let's now maybe go to the proof, what really proves what you and me are telling, that we are talking about the age of around 12,000 years, means 10,000 BC, because as we all know, our official history begins around 3,000 BC, starting with the big civilizations, the Etruscans, the Sumerians, the Pharaonic dynasties, and before, officially, there were just hunters and gatherers.
Yeah.
And now we make a jump of 7,000 years before and talking about buildings that we already today, with our technique, could not build, because we have the technique to cut now these stones, but we have no machines to make blocks of these amazing sizes, from 5 tons to 28 tons.
Well, that's true. And, you know, I'm an engineer, and I've done some project management, and I look at, what is it, about 1.4 million blocks it took to build the complex. And the period of time in which it was done and where the stones were quarried in the Sudan and in Aswan. And I'm saying to myself, wait a minute, there's two things missing here. One is a system of communication between here and Sudan and Aswan, a standard system of measurement. And the other is a transport system. Well, I spoke to the officials in Egypt, and they said, well, they floated the blocks on the Nile up to this area. And I said, well, how many blocks are there on the floor of the Nile? Because 1.4 million attempts, you know they're going to make one or two mistakes. Somewhere on that river bottom, there's a bunch of blocks and a bunch of old boats. And they're not there.
Exactly. And I don't know if you heard about, some people have tried to prove this but in the end of the 90s. And they put an 8-ton block of a big similar ship like in the ancient times. And in 2-3 seconds, it was sunken. So it's no chance to bring them. And we talk maybe to go just a moment to the numbers. The big pyramid, we talk about 91 million cubic feet. And a total weight around 7 million tons. And we talk about around, in newer calculations, we talk about 2.3 million blocks, which were used to build just the big pyramid, not even with together with the middle and the small. And so, again, for making a comparison about Cheops as builder, this would mean that during his reign, which was officially like 25 years, this would mean that they have to lay 21 blocks per hour in this size, 12 hours a day, 365 days a year. And remember, that, like you said, first they have to be transported to the city and cut into the different sizes, ranging from 5 to 28 tons. And it's really urgent what you say to mention that the red granite doesn't, you cannot find it in the area of Giza and Cairo, but in Aswan, and this is about 1,200 kilometers away. So a big question, and this also leads us back again to the question, who has built this?
Yeah, I mean, if the Egyptians inherited the pyramids, and I think it's pretty clear that they did, then who used to live there? And why would they build such a complex in that location?
Exactly. And when you say in this location, maybe before we go to the proof line about the age and the builders, it's also interesting to make one or two examples about the placement. Because the pyramid is perfectly placed on the globe on the 30th length and wide latitude, and it's in this place of position. My English, maybe I'm searching for words. It's located at 38 parallel, and it's equally distant from the center of the Earth as it's from the North Pole. And the meridian upon which the big pyramid stands leads through more continents than all others, and this north-south line cuts the global land masses exactly into half. And as it sits also on this line, when you follow around the globe, cuts the continents in half. So the position, just if we talk about the placement of the big pyramid and in this geodetic fixed point, this could only have been calculated by someone who knew that the Earth to be a sphere and who had measurements of both the land masses and the oceans. And you know, we just have this knowledge some 100 years. So it's really amazing just to talk about the placement of this.
Well, I think we've got enough history to see that ancient civilizations sailed around the Earth lots of times and made all kinds of maps, and still they did not know that this was the geocenter of the Earth, that is to say, the center of all landmass above the sea. I think that this information would have to come after a view of the Earth from space. So now you have this information. Okay, so this is the exact center of all the land masses on the Earth. Two things we know now. First of all, the Earth hasn't changed much in the last 12,000 years. The center of the Earth is still the center of the Earth. The second thing is, why is it so important? Why not build it on a coastline? Why not build it on a mountain? Why not build it in the middle of the desert or in the middle of civilization? Why build it in the center of all the land masses of the Earth unless you were trying to preserve something from destruction?
Exactly, and that was the main purpose. We will come back soon on this about the three steps of building. But if you and me now are telling the people about an age of 12,000 years, let's prove this, because we have more proofs for this than for the pharaonic theories. The first is that it's scientifically proven that the building method of these three pyramids, it's completely different to the building technique that the pharaohs have used in the 3rd, 4th, and 5th dynasty for all their other buildings, and that they were not able to handle this kind of stones and this kind of perfection and this kind of cutting. The second is that it's geologically proven that the large pyramid is at least 10,000 years old, and the best proof we have done by two great Americans, because it's geologically also proven after John Anthony West and Robert Schoch, that the Sphinx at least is about 12,000 years old, which also leads about on 10,000 BC. And The last one is proven by Robert Buval and Graham Hancock that the three pyramids and the three Sirius asterisks in the Osiris belt only 10,000 BC correspond together, and this was proven with NASA material. And exactly at this time, Bruce, the sun in the east was rising in the constellation of of the Lion in this time, and it was exact in front, in face of the big Sphinx looking into the east. And so we have like four proof lines which lead us to the date of 10,000 BC.
Well, the interesting thing, and you mentioned Robert Buval, I had a couple of discussions with him. And one of the, well, there are two remarkable things that he uncovered and really makes a great, great study about. One is the alignment of the complex, that it looks like the star complex of Orion, the three stars, the precise angle and arrangement, but also the alignment of the shafts in the temple, or in the pyramid, still seem to be pointed at the star Sirius after 12,000 years, which means that Sirius has not moved in 12,000 years.
Exactly. If we calculate also precession, the turning angle of the world. So already this also is calculated inside. And like you said, one of the so-called shafts for the air of the King's Chambers leads to Orion. The other leads to Alpha Draconis. And both of the Queen's Chamber, one leads to Sirius and one leads to the Small Bear. So each one of these four shafts really marks an asterisk constellation in space.
Well, I've had that question come up many times in discussions with friends. Some say that they're marking the stars of their homeland. Others say that that the pyramids might be sort of beacons to let a passerby from another world know that they're here, sort of like a big help message. And others say that there were regular transports between those worlds and this planet, and that maybe the builders of the pyramids are not from this neighborhood.
Yes, could be. I agree with each theory like a little, but I'm not talking about aliens, for example, because for me, even if I work together and talk about this also with Erich von Däniken, you know, for him, these were always aliens. But for me, these were our ancient brother and sisters. These were humans, but not always living on Earth. So like all our older brothers and sisters. And so maybe here it's the right point to come back on the question, who has built them? Because after my research, from my point of view, if I take all the knowledge we have today about Giza, if we put together, I can see like three building steps. So the first, it was done by the so-called Nater, the god kings, like mentioned also in the old Arabic, Greek, and Egypt sources. For us today, we call the Nater and the god kings the Lemurians. We talk about 30,000 years before Christ. And for me, they have built the subterranean first room at this special location. So for me, they have made the placement. And then with the building of this, I think we talk about the Hall of Amenti, they have virtually laid like the founding stones. And then we come to the second step of building. I continue there where you mentioned why they have chosen this place, because if you want to keep something in sure, you have to find a sure place. And so we arrive to the Atlantean civilizations, because when they start to know that the danger about the floods and the continental plate was really going up, they were searching for points to leave, I call it, their legacy. And they have really checked like the whole world. And finally, as far as we know and as far as I got, they had three places, one in Central America, let's say from Mexico to Peru, one in the north of Africa, it's around Giza, and one in India, between today's India and China. And finally, they have chosen Giza, I think also about the reason, because the Hall of Amenti of the Lemurians was there as a very special and holy place. And they liked not just to save the legacy, but also to mark it in different ways so that later civilization could found and understand this. So for me, the Atlanteans has built the other parts of the underground complex, and then finally put on the top the three megalithic pyramids and the Sphinx. And so the third step were built by the royal lines. And these are mentioned also in the Greek and Arabic sources as the dynasties before the pharaonic dynasties. And they have added like fences, the additional temples, which were not there before, some of the ramps. And at last, we can call it also like the fourth step, the pharaonic dynasties. In this time, they have joined hundreds of mastaba burials and caves all over the Giza Plateau, like we see today, like as a big graveyard, because it was really a sacred place. And just these real tombs with human skeletons were graves of the pharaonic dynasties. But you remember, there was not found one skeleton or a sarcophagus or something else, which leads to the theory that it was a cave inside the three pyramids. So we have to make a difference between these times and building steps.
You know, it always fascinates me when I go there and I see the stark contrast between what really could be a great exploration into the history, into the archaeology, even the anthropology of this area.
Yes.
And what is really happening. The claim that Egyptians built this, the claim that, well, not really the claim, I would say the control of these antiquities by the state has really denied the world a true exploration of all of these areas. And obviously, you mentioned in your book, and we've talked about on this program, and of course we've met with Hani El-Zeini and others in Egypt, where we've heard the stories of how the ministers of antiquity over the years have taken credit for discoveries that have been made by great explorers that have come to Egypt over the decades.
Yes.
And this is, you know, it's really a travesty. And I guess one of the worries that I have is that now that there is less organization in Egypt, it's a little more chaotic since the uprising, I wonder about the integrity of these antiquities. Will they be protected? Will the truth of these, you know, finally be let out? I was fascinated by your mention of the Neters, and this goes all the way back to the Shemsu Hor, the masters of moving great stones. which I don't know, what does that go back 14,000-15,000 years? We're just blown away by that moving 1 million pound blocks, like setting them 60-80 feet in the air in precarious positions with interlocking stones so tight you can't fit a razor blade in between them. My question is, I guess, more of an engineering one. Why would they do that? Why not just make it out of smaller stones? Why not make it out of another material other than stone? If they were this advanced,
maybe at this time it was like the normal way to build something very special, which is out of every range. I know from your homepage that you already also traveled the world. You see the same, for example, in China with the pyramids, or you see it in Central America. Even in Machu Picchu, there is an old megalithic center, stone blocks, and around this and on the top of this, it's built all this about the Incas. And so there is the same point of view, because the rest around is from the Incas. They claim that they say in the history science the whole complex was built by them. But we have to make a difference. But we have this also in in Peru, in Ollantaytambo, and in Tiahuanaco. With similar red granite buildings cutted in this amazing way. And about the theory of building, my actual point of view, because you know this story is not already finished, we have to learn a lot about this, but from my point of view now, it was built with the knowledge about vibrations. And you know, I remember this was the point which originally leads me there for the first trip, because we know also from scientific view, finally all life and all what we see in this wonderful creation, finally it's light and vibration.
Sure.
And if you have a big knowledge about this, and imagine for a moment, you could stand in front of a stone block and change the vibration of the material. You can make with this a block which weighs 5 tons, maybe for a moment into a weight of 50 kilo. Or if you knew about the vibrations of all the materials, you can also work on the consistency of material. So, for example, something which is normally like red granite, hard as iron, for some time you turn in a material vibration that allows you to cut this maybe like a piece of bread, joking. So for me the explanation how it was also for them possible to build this, we will find in the knowledge about vibration.
You mentioned that the great Lemurian king or kings came to the Giza Plateau and laid the cornerstone for the rooms, the rooms of records, to preserve the knowledge of their life and their livelihood and their beliefs. And you mentioned in the book that the sacred geometry, including the flower of life and the Merkaba, were used. And this really goes back to these vibrations, this relationship between this golden mean ratio of vibrations, which you know, as a physicist, I see in chemistry and physics and in the formation of stars and planets rotating around stars, this golden mean is really the vibration of creation. It's the vibration of constructive interference, which is why, you know, we only see about 5% of our universe. The rest of the universe is not vibrating at the correct ratio, and so cannot be made physical, cannot manifest. Exactly. But it's clear that these ancients did have a mastery of that, and they did know how to move things and to manipulate solids just the way you say. And that's why they used this sacred geometry in building these complexes.
Yes.
And one of the things I noticed about the Great Pyramid, and this was actually brought to my attention by Drunvala Melchizedek, that the granite slabs that are above the King's Chamber are spaced out in such a way that a Fibonacci spiral drawn from the sarcophagus outward will reflect off the bottom sides of each one of those slabs as you increase the size of the spiral. But only...
And if I can just join the solar cross shaft outside in the desert marks this point also with the golden spiral which goes to the three top points of the three pyramids and the Sphinx. So you find this and also the magic of P at different places. And even for the pharaonic theory about 2500 BC at this time, they didn't knew about this. Also for us today, this is knowledge we have some hundreds of years. So this is really amazing. You find there the holy geometry nearly everywhere. They have built nothing there which is originally there, which is not based on holy geometry.
Well, this knowledge, you know, comes from... so you have loud vehicles going by. This knowledge was descended then from Lemuria and from Atlantis. So
yes,
where did they come from, and why? Why did they leave Lemuria and Atlantis to come to this Giza area to build this complex?
For me, here also we have to separate. Lemurians really have built like the first rooms, and I guess it was the Hall of Amenti. You mentioned Drunvalo Melchizedek. You find... So about this also in his work, which I agree most. And the other part about the Hall of Records, on my point of view, it was built by the Atlanteans, and they were really preparing about what's happened in this time around 10,000 BC, because then afterwards... really happened something incredible, because imagine that really the Atlantic continental plate was broken into two parts, and that's why the Atlantic continent was sunken down, which is today the sea. And other parts of continents, let's say, for example, South America was lifted up, because when you were in Peru at the Titicaca Sea, it's scientifically proven that around 10,000 BC, this was on sea level.
Ah, I see.
So what happens around 10,000 BC really changed... like the face of the earth.
Right. Yeah, I believe that. And then and about that time is when these great migrations began to occur. But what really caused the cataclysm? What was going on at that time? Was there a great conflict? Was this just earth upheavals? Were we being assaulted from outer space? What was going on?
Yeah, it's difficult to say. There I am not already quite sure what really happens. There are like three main points. One is talking about a meteorite which was really... sometimes I'm searching for words, sorry. Which really hit... the Earth. So that this was the reason that this continental plate was broken. Other talk about the incredible war of the souls from light and the dark, and that the technique they have used was also based on vibration, and that the Atlanteans try to refuse this, to defend this with their knowledge about vibration using very huge Merkabas. And then could be that all this like went out of control. If we compare of today, like the atomic energy systems in today's, we have not anymore the control. It turned, ran out of control. And that this was finally the reason that the continental plate was broken. And the third say that just about the attacks, because from outer space they have used certain kind of weapons which have destroyed this continental plate. But finally, in wherever, well, whatever way, it's a fact that we can also prove scientifically that this continental plate was broken, and this has caused the big floats, like we read about in the Bible or in the Vedic Indian sources, or in the Quran, or in the North and South American native writings. You find it nearly in every legend of the old big cultures that there was a time where a big part of the earth was turning on the water under the sea. And today we know about the power of a tsunami, but imagine if caused by something like this, if this happens all around the world. So there were like thousands of floods which making together this one big flood that we read in the different ancient sources. So for me, this fits very well together.
Yes, I support that as well. I read the really landmark work by Allen and Dallaire called Cataclysm, The Day the Earth Nearly Died. If you get a chance, listeners, you should read that book too. It's a little dry, but you know, paleobotany and paleobiology is something that's very fascinating. But what they discovered was exactly what Rico Paganini is saying, that there were these giant waves like tsunamis that are beyond your imagination, 2,000, 3,000 feet high, traveling at speeds of several hundred miles an hour, that literally just swept the coastlines of the earth and wiped civilizations out and cleaned the beaches of everything man had built and mashed them all together and jammed samples of this into what these two great scientists call muck vents. These are crevices in the mountains that were literally filled with the mud that was created from these floods, which created a kind of frozen snapshot of everything that was in this slurry that was being sloshed around the earth. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, a lot of things which we did not think lived together on the earth are in that mud. And that's the most fascinating proof that we have, that what Rico Paganini is saying here is exactly true, that there was a great cataclysm that caused maybe not the entire earth to be covered by water at one time, but certainly most of the earth was covered by water in a short period of time with these gigantic vibrational water waves that went around the planet.
Exactly. And so here we also can connect with the line we talked before, why this place was chosen, because before and after the fall of the continent of Atlantis, they proved the places, and like we mentioned before, they chose Egypt reasonably. They have find there the best and safest underground, which they knew that it could stay in quite a balance during what could happen. and put their legacy before the Continental was break. So this place was chosen, of course, of the history, the alignments, and also like the rocks, because they were perfect for this. And it's also interesting at the 3 points that they have searched after this incredible happening which turned up the world, in these 3 places, in India, China, in Egypt, and in Peru, Mexico, were arising out of nothing 3 big civilizations, all building pyramids in different sizes, all having knowledge about the alignments on the world. And all of these 3 cultures have left us a cyclic calendar. We are always just talking about the Maya calendar, about 2012, and forget that the Vedic calendar with the yugas, it's also around 26,000 years. The calendar which is built in the Big Pyramid, also it has a during about 26,000 years. And even our astrological calendar has a turning cycle of 26,000 years. And this also now fits perfectly together by the end of 2012, because in a space window of about 120 years, all these calendars are going to an end and have a new beginning. And in the same time next years will happen the galactic constellation, which also scientifically happens just all 26,000 years. So also about this, they had an incredible knowledge, which we are discovering today step by step, and start to understand what this means to us today.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I've studied a little bit of that and, you know, written a little bit of my own on it. I don't claim to know it all, but it is a marvelous coincidence that we have, you know, these ancient civilizations all displaying stellar alignments, all displaying incredible architecture, mathematics, engineering, architecture, but speaking different languages, and even the people having a different physical appearance as far as their anthropological makeup. But nevertheless, they have this common engineering. They have this common dating system. They have a relationship not only with the planet, but also with a set of stars which are off-planet. And I found that so fascinating that it's difficult to lay it down. Do we have the answers? No, not really. Lots of people think that the world is going to end in 2012, and I think that's a lot of misinformation.
Yes.
A lot of people think we're going to go through a consciousness shift, and I think that is happening around us. If you're not aware of it, then I think you're just out of step with what's going on. And I think that there are earth changes going on. We have severe climate change that has taken place in the last 10 years. We've had earthquakes. We had one just this morning in Oklahoma, the biggest in the state's history. 2 months ago, we had one in Virginia, the biggest in the state's history. You know, the earth is responding to these galactic vibrations, as is every planet in the solar system.
Mm-hmm. If I can join a little, I give you a complete confirmation about my point of view. About the 4 calendars and what will happen, now in December comes out the second volume of the trilogy. It's called Day Legacy. And there you will find a detailed comparison of these calendars. And in the end, I have put them all 4 together, and they fit wonderfully. And I really like to confirm it very clear to all the listeners. Don't be afraid about 2012. The world will not sink down in fire. It's like a calendar is ending and a new cycle is beginning, but it has a lot of changement in this time. And like Brooks mentioned, look around, open your mind, open your heart, and you will see what's going on. And if you open your heart, this is the best preparation for what people called about the consciousness shift. So this is not something that happens just outside. This is something that happens in our hearts, in our souls, in our minds. And we have to take care about this. And third point about the movement of the earth. I am writing the third volume. It's Gaia Legacy. And this is all about this. There you find a report about the 14 main megalithic places on Earth and how they are connected. Because if we turn back the continents in the position they had before this catastrophe in the Atlantic times, they have built like the form of a Merkaba star into the Earth's sphere. And it's true that it's now the moving getting higher and higher. We have made a statistic. You will find this also on our homepage, which we really prove how fast it's going up, even the rhythm. And we have just in the last 4 or 5 years in each category, earthquake, volcanics, floods, tsunamis, we have arrived at the highest point at the most big destruction since we are measuring this kind of catastrophes.
Yes, I couldn't agree more on all levels. Not only that it is a new beginning, it is not going to happen in a 24-hour period on December 21st.
Exactly.
We're going to ramp up to it. It may peak on or around that time, depending upon how accurately we're interpreting these calendars. And then it may last for some decades afterward. But it is a marvelous time to be alive. No question about it.
Yes. So let's, even if the world looks strange today and what's going on politically, economically, and in the scientific, it's really... scaring in some way, but let's be strong. Let's be based on the main knowledge and go through this, because it leads us to a new way of, let's say, living of civilization. Because we learn now that we have to change and we cannot continue to act like this with Mother Earth, because she allows us to live, to eat, to to drink, and to make this experience that we make as human beings on this Earth. So I wish really everybody a lot of light and love to see this, to feel this, and also to see all the big chances that this time is bringing to us.
Well, I couldn't have said it better. Rico, this book, Giza Legacy, is the first book in the series. The Day Legacy, that's DEI, brings all the calendars together, and the third volume is in progress. How do our listeners find your books?
In normal bookstores or by Amazon, you know, like the usual ways, you can get already the Giza Legacy. The Day Legacy will come out in English by the beginning of December, so it's coming out soon. And the Gaia Legacy will come out first in German in June and in English about October, November 2012. And on each book you will find also with the same title, like Giza Legacy.ch. On each book you find there's some back information, you find the video, and you find also where you can get it if you like.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on X Squared Radio. I think in some ways we're brothers. We've explored. I looked at your 14 places that are listed in the book on one page, And remarkably enough, I've been to almost all those areas. I've got maybe three on one and two on the other to go to, and I've seen them all. And it's amazing that we have this synergy, and I really appreciate you coming on the program.
Same to me. It was a big pleasure, and I also feel the same, Bruce.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Rico Paganini, author of Giza Legacy. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and all the best for everybody out there.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. So glad you're here with us this evening. Great interview with Rico Paganini, author of Giza Legacy. Lisa Gerard and The Unfolding off her album with Peter Bork. By the way, did you know that brain gene activity changes throughout life. Kind of an interesting science, and we're just beginning to understand it. Actually, human brains all work pretty much the same, use roughly the same genes in the same way to build and maintain the infrastructure that makes people who they are. Although there's some argument about whether the mind actually exists in the brain or not. Maybe it's superliminal to the body itself, to the brain itself. Certainly individuals that have been born without brains or partial brains or had brain injuries and yet still have a mind, still able to think, still have personalities, desire. There is pretty strong evidence that the brain is independent. It is maybe just a lens for the consciousness. But there are new studies that show that most everybody's brain is about the same. And by charting the brain's genetic activity from before birth to old age, the studies reveal that the brain continually remodels itself in predictable ways throughout life. Now, of course, it depends on, I think, how you use the brain, whether you're studying and pushing yourself to learn new things, to memorize new things, to cross-link different disciplines like music and business or architecture and philosophy. Cross-linking thoughts definitely allows you to recall memories better. When you can recall memories better, you can formulate thoughts better. And this allows you to perhaps stay sharper in the mind. In addition to uncovering details of how the brain grows and ages, the results of these studies may help scientists better understand what goes awry in brain disorders such as schizophrenia and even autism. The complexity of the brain is actually mind-numbing, says neuroscientist Steven Ginsberg of the Nathan Klein Institute at New York University Langone Medical Center, who wasn't involved in the studies, but it puts the brain in rarefied air. In the studies published in the October 27th issue of Nature, researchers focused not on DNA, virtually every cell's raw genetic material is identical, but on when, where, and for how long each gene is turned on over the course of a person's life. To do this, the researchers measured the levels of mRNA, a molecule whose appearance marks one of the first steps in executing the orders contained in a gene. You see, genes have a choice in which proteins they can make and how they operate. Those choices are influenced by the environment. And the environment means, you know, how much alcohol you consume or don't consume, whether you smoke or not, what kind of stress you're under, what kind of food you eat, and also the consciousness in that human body, whether it is exhibiting a positive attitude or a negative attitude, whether it's generally happy and uplifting and looking forward to life, or whether it's pessimistic and even, you know, chronologically ill all the time, or a pessimistic person. That also creates an atmosphere which has an effect on the genetic activity of the brain. In post-mortem samples of donated brains that ranged in age from weeks after conception to old age, this was carefully studied. These different patterns of mRNA levels distinguish the brain from a heart, for instance, and a human from a mouse, too, says Nidad Sestan of Yale University School of Medicine. You remember my brother was chairman of physiology at Yale for 10 years. This individual, Nidad Sestan, is also a co-author of one of the studies. Essentially, we carry the same genes as mice, he says. However, in us, these genes are up to something quite different. To see what those genes are up to, Sestan's study examined our mRNA levels on different genes in 57 brain samples. The team divided the brain tissue up by region, so they were also able to get an idea of genes' behavior in different parts of the brain. A parallel study headed by Joel Kleinman of the National Institute of Mental Health in Bethesda and looked at gene behavior in 269 brain samples from a single region called the prefrontal cortex that also spanned the lifetime. This approach allowed the researchers to get access to the brain that had previously been impossible. One of the limitations in studying human brain development is that you cannot do experiments, Sestan says. It's very hard to understand when things happen. Both studies found lots of variation in gene behavior at different life stages, but one particular period stood out. The prenatal brain had massive changes in gene activity. Many genes there were pumping out big quantities of mRNA, and this production abruptly slowed after birth. Prenatally, things are changing faster than they change at any other time, says Carlo Colantupni of the Leibniz Institute for Brain Development at Johns Hopkins University, where my brother was dean of physiology. Things are happening very fast in there. Kleinman and his colleagues turned up a curious finding. Many of the genes that slow down right after birth show a surge of activity as a person gets older. The biggest changes that are going on occur fetally, he says, and then they drop off until midlife. Then, in the 50s to 70s, expression changes pick up again and become quite dramatic. Wow. That's when the awakening happens for a lot of people. Sometimes it occurs at ages 9 and 10, but oftentimes the human is not allowed to be sovereign at that time. They're ruled over by their parents. They're ruled over by the school or by authority figures. However, in the 50s and 60s, when the brain is allowed to reach out and when individuals are allowed to seize upon their sovereignty once again, they're no longer restricted by the day-to-day grind, the things that you have to do every day, and now they can reach out and do the things they want to do every day. Now you begin to see the brain begin to pick up, and these expressions become very, very dramatic. Researchers don't yet know what to make of this reversal, says Colantupni. We have just scratched the surface of what that means. Genes involved with building new brain cells were highly active early on, and then the activity quickly fell after birth. After these genes grew less active, genes involved in linking up nerve cells took on a greater role and became busier. I really am sorry for the raspiness of my voice. You'll just have to put up with it for the rest of this hour. I'll try to speak softer and maybe make it through this hour. It would really help if you called in and helped me out a little bit. 888-429-5471 in North America. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, 530-413-4511. I know the plague has been going around. One of our listeners wrote me in on Skype. His name is Ted, and he's from British Columbia. Wanted me to make sure that you are aware that as this asteroid is approaching us on this coming Tuesday, November 9th, coincidentally, or perhaps maybe not coincidentally, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, in coordination with the FCC, that's the Federal Communications Commission, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA, will conduct the first nationwide emergency alert system on the same day at 2 p.m. Eastern. Now, you know, for those of you that are my age, you remember the birth of the emergency broadcast system. This is only a test. Should it not be a test, you would be advised to blah, blah, blah. You know where those. Well, those were kind of local. They happened on TV. They happened on radio. It was just kind of a PSA, a public service announcement. This is the first time that radio, TV, all available channels on the cable and on the networks will be seized at the same time, and they will be putting forth a single message on the same day that YU-55 makes its closest pass to Earth. Just interesting coincidence, I'm sure. if you're out there and your brain activity is heightened because of listening to X Squared Radio, we certainly understand that. I don't want to say that teenagers have less brain activity than grown-ups do, but gosh, it's awful easy to notice from time to time. And I just think that people from 50 and 60 and maybe on up in their 70s are finally getting to do the things that they always wanted to do. They're getting to travel. They're getting to read. They're getting to enjoy the arts. One of my listeners, my loyal listeners, Alex, says the brain is the CPU. The genes are the hard drive. Well, pretty close, Alex. Actually, the cell wall is the hard drive. It's programmed and runs a program. The genes are inside the cell, and they're actually a designed molecule that are a protein factory. That's what they do. They make proteins. Each gene in the human body has a variety of proteins that they can make. Proteins make up most of the structure of the human body. They're also responsible for communication, enzymes, hormones, things like that, all made by genetics. Now, it used to be thought that we were slaves to our genetics. If you were born of good genes, why, you were healthy, you were strong, you were fast, you were smart, you were rich, all of those things. Well, we have learned in modern times that that's just utter nonsense, that children born in abject poverty, with handicaps, blindness, crippled, can overcome these things and become great leaders and also very successful businessmen. So genetics has nothing to do with it. It is all about determination. It is all about the will of the being that is inside that human body, putting enough positive energy out, enough energy toward a dream, that it makes that dream resonate with the universe in such a way that the bounty unfolds before them. It is about focus. It is about waking up every single day and staying focused upon that dream. It is about never settling for that which you do not love. That's what it's about. It is somewhat about what you eat. If you're well fed, if you're eating from your local environment instead of from distant environments, you can build up immunity to those things that affect your immediate life. That is the science behind the genetics. So let's see now if we can go to the phones a little bit. I believe Matt is back from Montana. Let's get him on the phone. Matt, what's on your mind?
Hey, Brooks. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to first say I enjoyed the your interview with the guy that talked about the Giza Plateau. That's all very interesting. That's stuff I've been studying myself for a while. I've been following Carmen Bolter's work on that, and yeah, I generally agree with what you guys are saying. I'm primarily calling about, I read your book, Remembering the Future. You mind talking about that?
Yeah, sure. Let's talk.
Okay.
You want to know why I originally wrote the book, or is there a particular point in there that you want to talk about?
Well, I have a physics background myself, and though I did enjoy the book, I just found a lot of the technical issues, I guess, questionable. I guess one thing I just wanted to ask, where you got your PhD from?
I got it from a diploma mill out of a box of Cracker Jacks. It really doesn't matter. I don't like to compare sheepskins. It's not really important. I do understand the questionability of some of the ideas in the book. The mathematics is irrefutable. The way that I manipulated the Fibonacci sequence as a Fibonacci process, taking two numbers and putting them together and carrying those out in the same manner to come up with the golden mean after 8 iterations, it didn't matter, you know, whether I took irrational numbers or whether I took imaginary numbers or decimals or fractions, it worked out the same. So whether it's a mathematical value or a value of energy, it has to be the same. That's really the only jump in theory that I made. The clinical proof that the past and the future can be affected by that energy is completely independent of my studies and is a matter of scientific fact. So I just tried to put the two things together and give people some scientific support to the idea that their intention does affect the future and can affect the past.
Yeah, that is something I did have a lot of resonance with. And, I did work out the math. I mean, I was very surprised to find that when you did the Fibonacci sequence with complex numbers, as you say, you still get the golden ratio. And so,
that was mind-blowing to me. I had no idea I was going to find that.
I agree with you. Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, you do mention some of the other schools where you got your degrees from, and I haven't found anywhere where you got the PhD from. So that's the only question that I leave, and, I'll listen. I would appreciate it if you could just say that. But that's the end of my call. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. Yeah, I think the PhD was probably one of the worst decisions of my life. Just to be personal with you. I found that as I kept going with my education, all the way through Tennessee Tech and UCLA and University of North Dakota and Western Kentucky University and Kennedy Western University, and kept adding credits and adding value to my education, I became less and less employable. I always wanted the PhD. I worked for it. Online classes are not affiliated, so it's not affiliated with the direct university. Do you have to work for it? Yes, you do. Is it harder? In my opinion, it is, because you have to get yourself up every day. You don't have a professor. You don't have a classroom to go to every single day. You don't have the discipline of a classroom. So you really have to be a self-starter. And honestly, if it wasn't for extension classes and online opportunities, I probably would have never got the advanced degree. I just was working too hard, too many hours, raising kids. And, I make no apologies for it. But I have in the past told people that I got an online advanced degree, and I've been excoriated for it in the public. So rather than suffer the slings and arrows of the ignorant, I just don't make any bones about it. You want to argue about the physics, we'll argue about the physics. You want to compare sheepskins, well, take on somebody that's affiliated. Hey, did you know that they're selling radioactive cars in Japan? Cars that were contaminated by radiation during the March nuclear meltdown in Japan are finding their way into the reeling nation's used car market. So, that's just one more thing. You have a car that's involved in a flood. You have a car that's, involved in a mudslide. You have a car that's involved in a little bit of stray radiation. Hey, come on. It's no big deal. Vehicles from the area around the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant, which suffered a series of meltdowns after the earthquake and tsunami of March 11th. And if you listen to one of the past programs, what appears to be an act of violence, an act of attack against Japan. They were supposed to be destroyed, all these cars, but unscrupulous dealers, like I can't believe the unscrupulous dealers in Japan, have registered them under new license plates and sold them. The Asahi Shimbun newspaper reported, unable to export the cars, they're selling them in Japan. Well, I would say, show me the Carfax, and you might as well bring along your Geiger counter. And also in the news, China is making blood from rice. I know it's kind of interesting. I think the vampires would be very interested in this. Dracula may have a square meal at last. Researchers in China believe they have found a way to produce and harvest large quantities of human serum albumin, a blood protein that is widely used in drug and vaccine production from ordinary grains of rice. It looks like an interesting technological step forward. Dr. Richard J. Benjamin, chief medical officer for the American National Red Cross, told Fox News. it could potentially produce large quantities in a reasonable time. I like the idea. According to the study, Yang, he and his colleagues discovered a way to produce the protein in rice seeds and were able to purify the HSA from it, obtaining about 2.75 grams of HSA per kilogram of rice. I wonder if the rice is still edible after that. The protein was tested on rats, and they found that the rice-produced HSA was chemically equivalent to the blood-derived version. The disadvantage of what we currently use is that it is a blood product, which means it could transmit infection, of course, because blood-borne pathogens are a major problem. HSA is used in hospitals for resuscitation when patients need fluids when they have lost blood, or for burn victims. According to the authors of the study, the findings suggest that the transgenic rice seeds may be a cost-effective source for HSA and might help satisfy an increasing worldwide demand for protein that does not have the risk of blood-borne pathogens. What a great idea. How innovative can you be? China's space launch was a success. You know, the Shendao 8 blasted off from the Gobi Desert in China's northwest the other day before separating from its carrier rocket about 120 miles above the Earth. And it is going to join with the Tiangong, that's a heavenly place craft, which China launched a little while ago. It's going to join up in a couple of days, and this is really going to move China's space program forward. Keep in mind, this whole docking operation is taking place without any humans involved in the crafts themselves. The ability to dock successfully is crucial to the success of China's plans to build a space station where astronauts can live for several months, as they do on the International Space Station. The difference is that, of course, the International Space Station has taken a long time to build. It's a multinational, multi-billion dollar project. And this project is completely from China. That's the difference. This is not an international space station. This is a national space station. The technology is hard to master because of the two vessels placed in the same orbit and revolving around Earth at about 28,000 kilometers per hour must come together progressively to avoid destroying each other. In other words, nice and slow and easy, just a few inches a minute to bring these crafts together. China sees its space program as a symbol of its global stature. Huh, can you imagine that? Well, I guess we did the same thing in the 60s. Growing technical expertise and the Communist Party's success in turning around the fortunes of the once poverty-stricken nation. I hear that from a lot of people out there. Let's see. Capitalism, communism. Capitalism, communism. You know, 20 years ago I would have said capitalism hands down. But now I hear protesters on Wall Street saying, you know, communism is not that bad. I mean, after all, they are the richest country in the world. In September of 2008, the Shendao 7, piloted by three astronauts, carried out China's first spacewalk. The launch of the Tiangong 1 on September 29th, ahead of China's National Day on October 1st, was attended by Premier Wen Jiabao. While President Hu Jintao watched from a space flight control center in Beijing. But Beijing is playing catch-up in the space arena. The planned space docking will only emulate what the Americans and Russians achieved in the 1960s. Trust me, the growth curve is going to be very, very fast. The Chinese are good at copying things. They certainly have the technology. They certainly have the money, and I think they have the national will, which is something perhaps we have lacked in our space program for quite a long time. I don't like to see the loss of the national will. By the way, you know, as we're mapping the human genome throughout the world, one of the remarkable things from time to time is we discover markers that we didn't really expect to find. Man's ancestors mated with Neanderthals and other related hominids during human evolution, according to a new study. Researchers have found that people in East Asia share genetic material with, Denisovans, who got the name from the cave in Siberia where they were first found. The new study covers a larger part of the world than earlier research, and it is clear that it is not as simple as previously thought. We're talking about Siberians sharing DNA with extinct human species. Professor Matthias Jakobsen of Uppsala University in Sweden, who conducted the study together with graduate student Pontus Skoglund, said hybridization took place at several points in evolution, and the genetic traces of this can be found in several places in the world. He said, "We'll probably be uncovering more events like these. I can just absolutely be assured of that." Previous studies have found two separate hybridization events, being so-called archaic humans, different from modern humans in both genetics and morphology, and the ancestors of modern humans after their emergence from Africa. There was hybridization between Neanderthals and the ancient ancestors of modern humans outside of Africa, and hybridization between Denisovans and the ancestors of indigenous Oceanians. Now, the interesting thing is that I think 2 or 3 years ago, I read a paper that said definitely Neanderthals were not the missing link, that there was no DNA in modern humans that matched Neanderthals. Now here we are 2 or 3 years later, and we're saying that Neanderthals were hybridized into the human race. Just interesting stuff. One of my listeners writes in and asks about the discussion regarding the missing worldwide gold reserves. I spoke a little bit about that actually a couple of times, and I was reading an article about this, and I found a table in the article. The table showed the American gold reserves and other countries' gold reserves in the year 1949, and then again in 1999. So this was like a 50-year span. In 1949, the United States had 702 million troy ounces of gold in Fort Knox. And in 1999, it was claimed that there was some 261 million troy ounces in Fort Knox. Well, just do a little bit of math, folks. That's about 440 million ounces, troy ounces of gold that are gone. Now, the latter table discussed the amount of gold Germany had, France had, Spain had, China and Japan. If you add all of those amounts of gold together, you still don't get to about 700 million troy ounces of gold. And surely there's been more gold found since 1949. Surely Germany and Paris and France, France and Spain and Japan and China have their own sources of gold. There should be even more gold, than not less gold, in this table. Somewhere, folks, somewhere, there's 400 to 500 million troy ounces of gold missing. It's not in Fort Knox. It's not where it's supposed to be. And what I found very remarkable in the article is occasionally gold is moved from nation to nation to balance out the balance of trade. Because we move goods back and forth, sometimes we end up with a trade imbalance between the nations, and we have to move something of value between those nations to offset that imbalance. Typically, between large nations, that's been agreed to be gold. Such was the transfer of somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000 bars of gold from the United States to China. When the bars of gold arrived in China, they arrived all shiny, gold, and serial numbered, and had been kept in Fort Knox for many years. However, the Chinese asked for the bars to be audited. And so they drilled tiny holes into the bars, take the shavings from the hole, melt them down, and see what the gold content is. It should be somewhere around 99.99% pure. Surprise! The gold bars were made of tungsten, not gold. They had a thin layer of gold on the outside, but they were counterfeit. Counterfeit bars of gold in our own gold reserve. And we were so sure that they were gold, we transferred them to China as a balance of trade act. Just where did the gold go? Who has the gold? That's a really good question. I don't think we know. I don't think we know. And that's the frightening thing. Who has the gold? One other article I found that was very interesting. We'll wrap up the program tonight. Hold on a second. Got another note coming back. He says, LOL, that's funny. Yeah, I wish it was funny, but you know, it's like 10 guys coming to a big table to play poker. Each one has $1 billion. They put in chips, they sit down at the table, and they play. Somewhere along the progress of this game, it got to the point where no one at the table could ante up. Everyone at the table was broke. Well, that doesn't make any sense. That's not the way the game is played. You see, one player should have one huge pile of chips in front of him. If he's the guy that's going all in all the time and taking out the other players, eventually one player or two players end up with all the chips. The problem is all the chips are gone. Nobody can ante up. There are no banks in the United States able to loan money. There are no equity investors in the United States. There is no cash. There is no gold. So where did it go? Who has been skimming off the table all these years? Could it be the Anunnaki? Could it be that we have been giving out the gold off-world? Or could it be that it's sitting in someone else's Fort Knox? Why? What in the world could they be saving up for? If they keep up, there's not going to be anything left to buy. And last time I checked, you can't eat gold. But then again, it does come with its own fever, doesn't it? Did you know meditation improves the immune system, research shows. Meditation improves the immune system, reduces blood pressure, and even sharpens the mind, according to research. The practice, an essential part of Buddhist and Indian yoga traditions, has entered the mainstream as people try to find ways to combat stress and improve the quality of life. Now, new research suggests that the mindfulness meditation can have benefits for health and performance, including improved immune function, reduced blood pressure, and enhanced cognitive function. I can attest to that. I can tell you that regular meditation makes for great balance in one's life. You're able to handle the stress of daily life. You're able to tap into the vibrations, the very subtle vibrations of the universe, and assess how you're doing and make subtle changes to that level of consciousness, and to also pour positive energy back into yourself and emanate it to others. In doing this, you change your environment, your physical environment in which your biochemistry operates. The study published in the latest issue of the journal Perspectives on Psychological Science draws on existing scientific literature to attempt to explain the positive effects. The goal of this work, according to the author Britta Hazel of Justice Liebig University and Harvard Medical School, is to unveil the conceptual and mechanistic complexity of mindfulness. providing the big picture by arranging many findings like the pieces of a mosaic. The authors specifically identify four key components of what they call mindfulness, the state of meditation that may account for its effects: attention regulation, body awareness, emotion regulation, and sense of self. Together, these help us deal with the effects of stress. Stress is the mind killer. Stress is the body killer. Stress is the environment in which proteins begin to mutate and begin to form toxins and are unable to fight off simple things: colds, weaknesses, cancers, things like that. Dr. Hazel said the components of are closely intertwined, so an improvement in attention regulation, for example, may improve our awareness of our psychological state. Body awareness, in turn, helps us to recognize the emotions we are experiencing. She said, understanding the relationships between these components and the brain mechanisms that underlie them will allow clinicians to better tailor mindfulness interventions for their patients. I would say on the front end, on the front lines, in the trenches, we are our own psychologist. We are treating ourselves. When you go into meditation, you will learn not only all kinds of things about yourself, but you'll be able to tap into a higher consciousness of yourself, maybe a common consciousness that may exist in your community, your church, your family, and the race of humanity, and also what I would call an environmental consciousness, your awareness on the planet, your awareness in the solar system, your awareness in the galaxy and space, the fact that you are not insignificant, but are in fact very significant, that you are not unaware, but you are in fact omniscient, that you can actually behold everything. If just for a microsecond you discover the connectedness of your soul with everything else around you, and that has a profound effect on your sense of loneliness, your sense of worth, your ability to pick up the pieces of your own psyche and put it back together. One of my good friends, Maureen St. Germain, is a teacher of Merkaba meditation. She is my master. She's taught me all the advanced courses. She has a guided meditation that she does on a CD. It goes along with my book, Remembering the Future. And if you put these two together, you really get something going. It is really life-changing. It is creating an awareness in more people every single day than I see out there. I know Chris is writing in and saying that he's listened to the Merkaba 2 meditation CD, the guided meditation by Maureen St. Germain. He's read the book, and he says that her meditation is fantastic, and anyone who follows it will change their life just 3 times a day. I can tell you that if you spin up your Merkaba, your energy level inside of yourself using this guided meditation, once every other day, every 48 hours, you could protect yourself against disease, depression, loneliness. You could ensure your own success, your own sense of self-worth and value, and your ability to love yourself and your ability to love others will be vastly enhanced. What can be bad about that? Nothing. Nothing. It is great for yourself. And now we have a study to back it up. The framework underscores the point that mindfulness is not a vague cure at all. Effective mindfulness meditation requires training and practice, and it has distinct measurable effects on our subjective experiences, our behavior, and our brain function. This is Dr. Hazel, and she says, we hope that further research on this topic will enable a much broader spectrum of individuals to utilize mindfulness meditation as a versatile tool to facilitate change, both in psychotherapy and in everyday life. I'm not much on psychotherapy. I think that people that study the pathology of the mind, that is, the diseases of the mind, can certainly offer some enlightenment, but the actual treatment, the actual security of the sovereignty of the individual is completely driven by that individual themselves. Unless there is some chemical reason why or some traumatic reason why that person cannot access those things, then meditation, I believe, is a good key. This might also be the reason why we see people in their 50s and 60s changing the genetics of their brains, because they are beginning to involve themselves in these very self-aware activities, such as meditation. One of the things that we see when we look at the ancient civilization is a tremendous mindfulness of self, a tremendous ability to look at the self, to look at the community, to look at the state, and to stay focused upon the success of all of those. Every civilization that we've talked about tonight, whether we're talking about the Maya, the Toltec, the Olmecs, the ancient before the Egyptians, the Atlanteans, the Lemurians, all of their communities functioned for not decades, not centuries, but millennia. They were able to stay focused as a community and as a people. This did not come through tyranny, my fellow Earth explorers. This did not come through fear. This did not come through indoctrination. Far from it. It came from high levels of education, high levels of learning, and high levels of the ability to, I'm going to call it meditate. This doctor calls it mindfulness. I would call it maybe selffulness, that you realize that you are a sovereign being, that you are in charge of your life condition, and that you can manipulate it for good or for ill. And certainly there have been examples of both throughout history. As to which one was really happy, which one really had joy, for my money, for my psyche, I would say that those that wish mercy and charity upon those around them are happy. Those that wish oppression and dominance and see themselves as vastly superior to those around them, and that they themselves can live a lavish life full of wealth and opulence while those around them can starve and struggle for a simple, clean glass of water. I see it. You see the Gaddafis of the world. You see the Mubaraks of the world. You see the leaders, the despots around the planet that have at not only the expense of their people, but at the embezzlement of their nation, enjoyed these lifestyles. I can tell you they're not happy. In fact, the people under them, even in their misery, even in their short, disease-ridden, starving lifestyles, probably are more happy than the despot who rules over them in opulence. But I would like to see the conditions change, and I know you would too. I would like to see the true wealth. I would like to see the true bounty that this planet can pour forth. Not segmented to those who have somehow accumulated the ability to have more than they need, to have more than they want, to have more than they could need or want in 100 lifetimes. To see that even out, to see something like not, I'm not saying that we should redistribute wealth. I'm saying that there's enough wealth for everyone. Am I saying that you can live your life as a lazy bum, never learn to read, never lift a finger, never dig a ditch, never pull a thread through a piece of cloth with a needle? little more than digging into the meal with a fork and lifting it to your fat face. No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that everyone should be able to realize the fullness of their dreams. And for those that will not dream, for those that will not work, for those that will not strive to accomplish those dreams, perhaps there's less hope for your life condition as long as you desire those things. I would say desire, dream large, and go after it. I appreciate you being part of X Squared Radio tonight and X Squared Radio for the last 6 years. Your mercy, your patience with me has been immeasurable. And I will stay at it. I will have to leave you now because my voice has just about had it. I'll be back next week with more X Squared Radio. Thank you so much, Earth Explorers.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.